Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointsTC.
Welcome again to Think You Know the Presidents. I'm Flora McCarthy.
And I'm Lise Hand.
We're up to President number 8, Mary McAleese, first and only president from Northern Ireland and our second female president, and a stint of 2 terms in the Irish 1997 until 2011.
Yeah, like her 2 terms as president. I mean, it was a sort of, if you want to say, a bit of a riches to rags story in Ireland. Mm. But I mean, that aside, like, she did some really, really significant symbolic gestures that, I suppose it's fair to say, have gone down in the history books.
Did you ever imagine that Queen Elizabeth II would actually visit Ireland and speak in Irish? But look, before all that, allow me to introduce our special guest today. He's back, Matt Cooper. We didn't scare you off first time.
I don't scare that easily.
Well, I mean, do you know what? God forbid 2 women should be left alone in a studio talking about a woman president without a man to keep a good eye on us.
Is that a bit of sexist sarcasm there? Or not?
Should we let the run of ourselves? If not.
God forbid you should allow 2 women the run of a studio to talk about a woman president without having a man here to keep an eye on us.
You invited me in. I didn't force my way in, though, all right?
Okay, you two, just before we jump into today's episode, if you follow us, you can catch up on all the previous 7 stories in the series. Plugged on. Let's get on with it.
The theme of my presidency, the 8th presidency, is building bridges. These bridges require no engineering skills, but they will demand patience, imagination, and courage. For Ireland's pace of change is now bewilderingly fast. We grow more complex by the day.
So it's well known that Mary McAleese, Mary Lenehan, as she was, grew up in Northern Ireland, but the specifics often fly under the radar because what's particularly interesting is that she grew up in a Catholic family, but in what was largely a Protestant neighbourhood in North Belfast.
Very difficult.
Well, can I actually tell you a little bit? Because she grew up in Ardoyne, and I would know a little bit about this because that's where my late mother was from. And she would have grown up, and I would have grown up with all these stories from my mother of what it was like to live as a Catholic in the Ardoyne area on the Crumlin Road. And it made my mother very interested in Mary McAleese and her story subsequently when she emerged, because my mother had moved to marry my father, moved down to Cork and the rest of it. She found it very interesting that we had this woman emerging as a major political figure in the Republic. There would be quite, I think, a lot of people in the 1970s and whatever who would have felt that, particularly with the troubles ongoing in the north, and when you had partition at this stage over 50 years going on, that this separation had developed between North and South. And I think this was one of the interesting things about Mary McAleese's emergence as a TV reporter first and then a political figure. And then as we got to know the story of how her own father had moved, Paddy Lenehan had moved from Roscommon to work in Belfast originally in that area.
Do we know why he went north, Matt?
We went for work, it would seem, just 1939, which is an unusual time for somebody in the Republic from rural Roscommon to be moving north. But clearly there were family links there. And it seems that, as happens to many a good man, he met a woman when he was there. That's why he ended up settling in the north, but settling in Belfast in an area where it wasn't always necessarily easy to be a Catholic.
The family had first-hand experience of violence happening around them.
Well, yeah, there was 1972 in October, a 23-year-old woman was killed in a car bomb right outside the bar. Paddy went, that's Mary's father, ran to help her and she died. And it was a very traumatic experience for him and for all the family, as you
can
imagine.
That's right. I think she talked about that years later and just said that, you know, she reckoned he probably was suffering from, you know, a form of PTSD. And obviously, like many men of his generation, wouldn't necessarily talk about, you know, the trauma that happened as well. And, you know, they really were at the sharp end of what was going on.
There was another attack shortly afterwards, wasn't there?
Yeah, I mean, there was quite a dramatic one. December 8, 1972, gunman actually sprayed their home with more than 30 bullets while the parents, the whole family, were actually out. But it was said afterwards that, you know, there was bullet holes all over the mattresses where some of the children would have been sleeping. And so it was quite clear that they were being targeted. And they said that, you know, they were very lucky because they all could have been killed.
So they left, they were forced out by loyalists and the family moved to Andersonstown.
Which would have been a much more nationalist area. So actually, I used to spend my summers in the 1970s up in the Glen Road, which runs into Andersonstown. We used to look after my grandmother during the summer when my uncle and his family got out of Belfast for the 12th of July celebrations. We used to go up and look after her up there.
And do you remember that sense, that tension in the air?
Oh, yeah. I'm one of the rare, Southerners. My first memory as a child is British soldiers coming into the house in Grantia Park, looking for stuff in the garden, doing a search and coming into the house uninvited.
It's funny.
That's the type of thing that people remember, you know.
When you were doing that, going north for your summer holidays, I was in West Cork and we were... there was a huge influx of Northerners around the 12th of July coming down to holiday there.
People got out. It just wasn't safe to be there. I suppose I'm almost reluctant to start telling almost maybe war stories because I didn't have the lived experience of being in Belfast all through my childhood. I was a visitor for the month of July and would have spent time with my cousins there when they came back after the 12th of July or we go down to the caravan that they had in Newcastle. But you do become very much aware of, even as a child, of what's going on. So there would have been times when I remember walking down Grantia Park and suddenly hearing down at the end of the road there was a big explosion. It turned out the pub at the end of the road had been blown up. I remember the day that the three children were killed, which led to the establishment of the Peace People. Because
was that the Quinns?
No, was it the Maguire family? It was, and Mairead Corrigan and Betty Williams set up the Peace People after it. But it was Mairead Corrigan's family, and it was, I remember actually being stuck in a lengthy traffic jam and my uncle asking what had actually happened, and we were being told, oh, there's been an accident and children have been killed by a car that was getting away. You know, I remember, you know, regularly hearing shots going off because where we were would have been around the corner from Turf Lodge, which would have been, again, where there would have been a lot of IRA activity against the British armies.
But that's the thing. I mean, I think people forget that, you know, that how closely the violence came to them. I mean, even a few years later when Martin and Mary McAleese were getting married, in two really good friends of theirs had been invited to the wedding.
Oh, yeah.
And they failed to turn up. And when the newlyweds literally switched on the television news in a hotel that morning, the two of them had been shot dead in a gun and bomb attack in the restaurant outside Lisburn. And Mary McAleese talked about how she literally spent the first night of her honeymoon just curled up in a state of grief.
Yeah.
So, you know, you are talking about a woman that literally grew up with firsthand knowledge of violence visiting her, her family and people she loved.
And she said it was a totally dysfunctional society. But as you mentioned, the wedding there, she said she married dentist, of course, and politician Martin McAleese. And she said he and I were lucky to transcend the violence. We had opportunities.
Though I did come across a story about the lovely couple, and he played minor football. For Antrim.
You meant he was a miner down the mines? No.
Yeah, no, not actually a miner. No, no, he was kicking a ball. But there was...
It was for Antrim, which is the saying goes, hardly a footballing stronghold.
Oh, controversial. Okay, well, that's us now inundated with irate people. Kind of, yeah, great. Thank you very much, Matt.
No, there won't be too many defending Antrim football, in fairness.
Well, apparently she recounted afterwards when I think they were still courting, as they said, as you say, and they were playing a match. I think he was playing for Queens, perhaps. Poor old Martin received a blow to the nether regions on the pitch, and Mary took massive exception to this. And she was actually saying that the referee missed the fact that the man I was hoping to marry had just been kicked in a particular part of his anatomy. And I thought that wasn't a very fair thing to do. So apparently she ran onto the pitch to remonstrate with the referee, and she was literally hauled off the pitch. And she said, well, we won the match, but on the way home, I was voted man of the match.
I don't know, would he have preferred if a magic sponge had been applied?
Well, it has to be said that they did go on to have some children.
They did. No serious damage done. So she'd graduated in law from Queen's University in Belfast and became Reed Professor of Law in Trinity not long afterwards. And that is really interesting.
Why does that sound familiar?
Because her predecessor, Mary Robinson, had done exactly the same thing. And when you think about it, okay, so they had two very different presidencies, but the similarities in their around that early career stage are remarkable, because the two Marys, both Reed Professor of Criminal Law, they were both married with three kids.
Campaigning women,
human rights lawyers into civil rights, and
forthright.
Each was the youngest president ever, because they were both 46. But
that's
when
right.
Mary McAleese succeeded Mary Robinson, she beat that record by a few months.
But isn't it also very significant, as well as being the Reed Professor of Law in Trinity, that she got to the professorship in Queen's? That was not necessarily something that was easy for a Catholic to do in that era. And if memory serves correctly, I think there was always a little bit of bitterness on the part of one David Trimble about her advancement, because he would have been one of those who felt that perhaps he was better suited to such advancement. Didn't get it.
But she was a campaigner, wasn't she? I mean, this was something that she started, you know, her instinct was to campaign on various issues.
It was.
I remember her as a television reporter in the 1980s.
I do.
And she used to be on, I think, wasn't it before we had Today Tonight? It was Frontline, wasn't it?
It was Frontline, yeah.
And she was a reporter, and she would have been, I think at the time there were some figures in RTE who didn't like the idea of having a nationalist from Belfast reporting on issues
related to
the IRA. And I think...
she wasn't going to compromise.
No, and Owen Harris in particular, who later... distinguished himself by opposing her in the 1997 election campaign by describing her as a tribal time bomb. I think that was what the thing was. He would have been amongst those who perhaps that she crossed swords with at the time. And because remember, this was also a time in the 1980s when we had a thing called Section 31 as a broadcasting act.
Which she vehemently objected to as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. It was a form of censorship. Yeah.
She did speak subsequently about not having the happiest time, but in RTE, that she felt that she had been marginalised to a huge extent.
Also, she said that she was shocked on realising that people in the South just didn't care. Her words.
It's probably at this point that she probably understood that if she was going to start building bridges, they were going to be bloody long ones.
Well, she was always a campaigner, as you say. She was a founding member of the Campaign for Homosexual Law Reform, and she was involved in a lot of fora on... as Father Ted would say, ecumenical matters and other issues. And then along the way, she caught the beady or hooded eye of one Charles J. Haughey.
Yeah, she did. And she ended up standing unsuccessfully as a Fianna Fáil candidate for Dublin South East, which is now kind of amalgamated into a different constituency, in the 1987 general election. And she had no luck there, but she clearly impressed the movers and shakers in Fianna Fáil, because they came and tapped her up to run as their candidate. But of course, it wasn't all plain sailing and straightforward. In fact, her entry into the race caused quite a bit of knife fighting within ructions within Fianna Fáil. It ended up being quite the event, and with one party grandee who probably was hoping maybe that the Aras would revert back to what it was before the anomaly that was Mary Robinson, and would just become once again a kind of reward for superannuated Fianna Fáil politicians. But that wasn't what was going to happen. And I seem to recall, I think Bertie Ahern got up to his old shenanigans. I'm completely right on that.
Well, this Bertie Ahern had just won the general election in 1997, so his position in Fianna Fáil at this stage was pretty powerful. And Albert Reynolds, who of course had become Taoiseach, Fianna Fáil leader in 92, lost the position in 94, had to hand over through gritted teeth to Bertie. Yes. And remember when Albert Reynolds had first come in, he cleared out an awful lot of people.
Oh, the night, the long
and
nights,
then Bertie Ahern and his people wanted to get rid of what they regarded as the Country and Western Brigade.
Oh, yeah.
So when Albert Reynolds wanted to be the president, famously, Bertie Ahern showed him his vote before they went to the secret ballot.
Yeah.
Here you are, Albert.
And there was three people in the secret ballot, wasn't there? There was Michael O'Kennedy, who was sort of party grandee.
Former EU commissioner, yes.
Yeah, so he was sort of in as the sort of always the also-ran. Then, of course, there was Albert, who really thought he had it in the bag.
Yeah, and Bertie had manoeuvred Mary McAleese into position. And the story goes that when Albert saw, it was almost like something out of the Mafia,
yeah.
when he saw him actually displaying, here you are, here's my vote, I'm voting for you. Albert realised he had been stitched up and that he was done.
Yeah.
And it was going to be McAleese who was going to win.
There's famous footage of them all emerging from the room after the vote and Mary McAleese had won. And poor Albert, I mean, you can see his face is all sweaty and he's clearly in absolute shock because he really thought he had it in the bag. That was it. He was measuring the curtains. He thought he was in.
But what goes around comes around. And to take a contemporary sort of explanation to this, recently we've seen Micheál Martin deciding that he was not allowing one Bertie Ahern to get the Fianna Fáil nomination for many of the same reasons, because Bertie Ahern was afraid that issues in relation to Albert Reynolds and the Beef Tribunal was going to come up and was going to hobble his campaign.
And so they parachute, you could say, in candidates that hadn't come
just
up
to
the
stop,
party.
Yes, to stop somebody who was regarded as maybe looking back to the past that they didn't want to have examined.
Yeah.
So maybe Bertie Ahern was hoist by his own petard.
God, you know, you really, there isn't a patch of long grass around Leinster House that there isn't a whole pile of Fianna Fáilers disgruntled waiting for their turn. There's no doubt about it.
So it was a very nasty campaign, the nastiest.
There was a lot of accusations of dirty tricks been thrown around. I mean, there really was. It was everybody was just going at each other. A lot of what she did flew under the radar to a certain extent, certainly in the lead up to her first presidency. I mean, the whole thing about the tribal time bomb and concerns that she was very close to Sinn Féin, accusations, incorrect accusations that were thrown at her.
But you know what? It gave her an opportunity to articulate her views on Northern Ireland politics. And she knew better than Owen Harris or better than any of the other people having a go at her what it was like to grow up there. There was Mary McAleese, Mary Bonatti, who had been MEP, of course.
For Fine Gael, yep.
Grandniece of Michael Collins. There was Aidy Roach from the Turnbull Children's Project that she had set up. Dana, our former Eurovision winner from 1971 and an MEP. And Derek Nally.
Yeah, they were running
as former Association of Garda Sergeants and Inspectors, who recently, when the two of you were on The Last Word and we were talking about Sean T. O'Kelly and having the Guinness tap up in Áras an Uachtaráin, and I actually asked the question, do they still have it up there? And a listener actually did text into the programme to say that Mary Robinson had done away with the Guinness taps and Derek Nally, one of his campaign pledges had been he would bring them back if he was elected so that he would actually have a few hoolies up in the Áras in the tradition of previous presidents.
Well, I mean, that's not exactly, you know, like being a man of the people. I mean, how many people are going to get in there? I mean, if he was sort of offering to buy three rounds
you'd have gone up
in Ireland.
If the Guinness, I know you long enough. If the Guinness taps have been reinstated in Áras an Uachtaráin, you'd have wangled your way in there to avail of it.
She'd be first in the queue.
He knows me so well.
So she won a landslide victory in the end in what was initially regarded as really a two-horse race between herself and Fine Gael's Mary Bonatti.
She, in an interview after she left the presidency, she said that she, one night when these accusations during the election campaign were at their zenith, she decided that night that she was going to pull out of the contest because she thought that her work that she was doing behind the scenes with people like Alex Reid and so on was much more important than running for the presidency. And it was only, I think, the following morning when several people that were involved in the peace process in the North came out and said, she's playing a really important role. It's nonsense to say that she has, you know, she's politically aligned to anybody, that she decided to stay in the contest. But she said that she went to bed content with her decision to pull out of the contest. But that's how seriously she took her role. And this, of course, fed into her whole thing about building bridges.
Mary McAleese's contribution to the peace process was exceptionally important. And we shouldn't forget that perhaps she had the most influential spouse of all the presidents, in that Martin McAleese did an extraordinary amount of work behind the scenes, both with Republican and loyalist paramilitaries, setting up various events and things for them to come to.
Do you remember the 12th of July garden parties? So she got it in the neck from all sides when she decided that she was going to mark the 12th of July in Áras an Uachtaráin by inviting orange marching bands from Northern Ireland to celebrate on the lawns of the president's residence.
Well, of course,
you
this
know
was
the saying that you persuade more with honey than with vinegar, don't you, and stuff. And I think there was a degree of that.
Of course, you know, 1998, I mean, talk about a year of contrast to some extent. I mean, you had the incredible joy and relief around the signing of the Good Friday Agreement in April. But unfortunately, within a few months, you just had the devastation of the Omagh bombing, which just go to show the fragility of the whole process and just cast such a long shadow over the joy that was felt by the signing of the agreement. But by the end of the year, it was clear that everybody really wanted this to work and they wanted to acknowledge all the hard work that went into it. And December of 1998 saw the awarding of the Nobel Peace Prize to John Hume and David Trimble.
And you know what? You saying there about the devastation of Omagh, it really was a watershed moment where people said enough. And that's embodied in one very small little story, but a huge one in another way, with Áras an Uachtaráin links. So about 6 weeks before the Omagh bombing, so that summer, a group of school children from Buncrana in Donegal were on a day trip to Áras an Uachtaráin to see the president. And one of the little lads was Sean McLaughlin from Buncrana. And with his classmates, he'd written a poem called Across the Bridge of Hope, specially written for Mary McAleese because of her theme of her presidency of building bridges. So they gave her the poem. 6 weeks later, she attended his funeral and two of his classmates because they were blown up in the Omagh bombing.
God, how sad.
And you know what? At that funeral, she and Trimble were embracing each other. Now, we heard from Matt earlier how they had been adversaries in their college days, but this changed everything. Do you want a mad little fact?
Oh, I love a mad fact.
Couldn't vote for herself in the election.
Correct.
First president that couldn't.
That's right, yes, because at that stage you couldn't if you lived in Belfast. It's extraordinary.
But you still can't. You can't vote in our presidential election if you live in six counties.
Yeah.
You can stand, you can be nominated, you can be elected, but you can't vote for yourself.
You can get the centenarian bounty when you hit 100.
When it came to 2004, presumably if there had been an election in 2004, she would have been able to vote for herself on the basis that her residence was now Áras an Uachtaráin in the Phoenix Park. She didn't have to vote for herself. Because
she did something better, man. She nominated herself.
Yes.
I mean, let's face it. That was like the coolest thing of all. I mean, imagine signing that paper going, I nominate myself for the president.
We'll be right back after this quick break.
Her two terms as president were markedly different because the first one was during the Celtic Tiger. So 1997 to 2004, Celtic Tiger was roaring. The country was, you know, up and running, flying. Not everybody, and I totally disagree with this everybody partied line, but the perception was...
Well, you partied.
I didn't have
you were an ace partier.
I didn't have any money, though. I mean, I just partied in other people's largesse. I relied on the kindness of strangers, basically. So there was a difference. Or else I was just shoving in expenses to you, Matt, as my editor in the Sunday Tribune. We get on to this, but Ireland then, her second term, Ireland was just...
But that's the second half of her second term.
Yes,
remember,
I know.
Yeah.
But Ireland was on its knees at that time and she was out and about trying to basically get Ireland off the naughty step. So you could say that going out on trade missions in her second term made sense because she was there representing the country and she was trying to get us back on our feet. Her first term, she shipped some criticism by some people who said that she was too much of a cheerleader for the Celtic Tiger and didn't spend enough time actually speaking to them represented. That it wasn't all plain sailing through her first or second term. She did have her critics.
Oh, yeah, but I mean, that's the nature of it. You're always going to have critics. I mean, my recollection would differ slightly from yours in this, Lise, in that I don't think there was much of a demand during her second term for the president to be seen to speak out on economic issues. We all got completely caught up in the whole thing about the crash in 2008, the bank guarantee.
Austerity.
These were the government issues. And the presidency was entirely secondary. And given that the presidency has no role in any of those issues and could play no role, I think she did relatively little, except where she was. I mean, one of the most important things that happened when we were out with the begging bowl in 2010, 2011, when the IMF came in, the Troika at the end of 2010, don't forget, we got big loans from Britain as well. And this is before Britain became economically banjaxed. And I think the relationship that she had forged over the previous years with Queen Elizabeth very much worked to our advantage. And I think that time as well, when Queen Elizabeth came to her official state visit to Ireland in 2011, was very, very important for us economically, culturally, socially. And I think the Mary McAleese was perfectly placed to act as the host in relation to that.
When Queen Elizabeth did make her state visit here, I mean, that was the fifth time they'd actually met. As they'd met twice in London, they'd met once in Hillsborough Castle, and then they'd met once in Messines when the Irish Peace Park was being opened. So this was a relationship between Queen Elizabeth and Mary McAleese that, you know, was actually forged over several years. And they were, you know, they were actually friends by the time. They were friendly, at least by the time. I'm not saying that the Queen Elizabeth, you can be pals with the Queen, like BFF. But, you know, they got on.
She did sign letters, your friend Elizabeth.
Oh, that's true, yes. Mm. So maybe they were BFF. Yeah, were they BFF?
You were covering that state visit. What do you remember?
Oh, I was. All the briefings that all the journalists got beforehand were all security briefings. And there was genuine fear that something is going to happen to her. And the thing I have to say, as a journalist who'd worked for many years and covered loads of things, I never had more fun on any assignment in my life. And what I loved about it was when she first arrived, she was being whizzed through empty streets. And as the week went on, you saw the humanity come out.
Cork,
exactly.
In the old English market.
Cork, the English.
And, you know, and I'll tell you a funny
story. Cork people are very friendly, Matt.
Oh, jeez, I'm
the
surrounded.
Rebel country.
I am,
Lauren,
surrounded.
I'm delighted for that we've actually managed to establish that.
Oh, my God, yes. I'm surrounded. Well, I bet you I have a best Cork story out of all that, because I heard a great story about when she went to the English market. It was her last assignment, it was her last engagement before she literally took off. She was going straight to the airport. We were all, the media were all on the upstairs press gallery in the English market, which is this beautiful, beautiful, Victorian building with every kind of stall and all that. And we were looking down and we could see it all, and we were told that she was getting straight into her car. So we sort of strolled down thinking she was gone, and next thing we could hear cheering. So we ran out, and there she was, far side of the road, shaking hands and getting little bouquets of flowers and kids talking to her. An Irish member of the entourage told me afterwards that he was walking her to her car, and her security were like, "This way, ma'am." And she was like, "No, I'm going to go over and say hello." And they were like, "No, no, ma'am, you have to get into the car. We haven't vetted, you know, the area." And she turned
rogue.
Around and she went, "I'm going over there." The stark difference.
She wanted to engage with people.
From her whizzing through the empty streets of Dublin, people not knowing what to expect, and then that lovely interaction with the crowd, because she just knew it was a success.
Looking forward to it forever.
My understanding is that she had made several private, secret visits to Ireland in the decade before.
Oh.
And that when she went to Coolmore, it was not her first time. She had been there previously.
Yeah.
Looking at me, Lise, you agree with that?
I do, actually. I do agree with you on that, yeah.
But these were non-state, non-governmental. I mean, there were major tactical problems, given that you would have been a fear of an attack or something. But it was done in the utmost secrecy. Mm. And because of her absolute love of horses, and given that Coolmore is the preeminent breeding place, and having been there once about 20 years ago, I could say, I mean, it's like a 7-star hotel for horses.
Yeah.
It is quite extraordinary just how luxurious it actually is.
I mean, let's face it, she wouldn't need a passport. I mean, she doesn't have to fly in with, you know, Betty Windsor, like, you know, born
Ryanair.
You know, Ryanair or whatever. I mean, you know, they could actually parachute her in and out.
You don't need a passport to fly between Ireland and Britain, Lisa.
I know, don't spoil a good joke, Matt.
That moment in Dublin Castle, that moment.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about that?
Dublin Castle was extraordinary, and it was the set piece of the entire visit. And it was symbolic because here was like the, you know, the Queen, the British Queen, and in the sort of what was had been the sort of seat of British power, which was Dublin Castle. I was up on the balcony looking down, trying to see what was going on. And it was all very formal, and there was a top table, and obviously President McAleese was there, David Cameron. And the Queen stands up to make her little speech, and she does say those five words. Two things I will say. One, her Irish was actually really beautifully enunciated. And when you think of all the Hollywood stars that try and sort of do any kind of an Irish accent.
Mangle it.
Yeah. Irish.
Mangle it. I mean, we're not looking at you, Tom Cruise, and whatever else. There's so many of them, right? But it was actually just beautifully, her diction was perfect. And it wasn't so much the reaction of the crowd. There was actually, and it was like an electric shock. I still remember it. It was a surge of kind of energy.
Because here was the seat of British power, which had tried to suppress the Irish language for several hundred years.
Precisely. It changed the entire energy of the room. It went from just being a formal event to something quite emotional. And you just, the noise level rose. And
do I remember correctly? Mary McAleese get up, and did she just say, wow?
She did, yeah.
She said, wow.
Well, she just said that while she was sitting down.
Oh, she said she was sitting down.
She was sitting down. And there was quite a lot of emotion. I also seem to recall that David Cameron ended up in tears during that as well. Now, maybe even hitting the gin, I don't know. But he, you know, there was a huge amount of emotion in the room. And it really was quite an extraordinary moment. And there's a great story behind
it,
isn't there?
There is, because this was not supposed to happen. Mary McAleese had thought how wonderful it would be if Queen Elizabeth II would say a few words in Irish and for it to be there in Dublin Castle. But in all of the really involved protocol planning meetings, Buckingham Palace vetoed it. And the idea was, no way, it's too risky. If she stumbles in her Irish, the press, us lot, will have a field day. And it's the only story that they'll talk about, and that'll be on the front pages. But these two women had other ideas. And about a week before the visit, a British diplomat called Francis Campbell paid a courtesy call on Mary McAleese and Orison Uachtaráin, and they had been students together in Queen's, in Belfast. So they had a chat, had a cup of tea, and as he was leaving, he said, "What would you have coached her to say in Irish anyway, Mary?" And McAleese looked at him and said, "No way, Francis, not happening," off the table. And allegedly he took a crumpled old envelope out of his pocket and said, "Sure, go on, write it down there for me." And she wrote phonetically, Uachtaráin, O-O-K-T-A-R-E-I-N, Uachtaráin, agus Acharda. Off he went. Next thing she knew, Dublin Castle. And Queen Elizabeth rises to her feet.
How extraordinary. And where is that envelope?
I tracked it down for President's letters. So I was asking Mary, where did Francis Campbell end up? And she said he was then, a few years ago, Chancellor of a university in Australia, Fremantle. And so I phoned him up and I said, "You wouldn't still have that, would you?" And he said, "Well, it's in a desk somewhere." And he found it and he sent it to me. And he said, "That's actually a little piece of Irish history."
It is.
It certainly is.
What a brilliant detective work by you.
Thanks, it was great fun. Yeah,
I can imagine. You felt very proud when you got that. Mm. You should have.
It should be in a museum, I suppose.
I was going to say, is it just sort of in a frame on your wall or in a drawer somewhere?
It's in an email. Well, he still has the original. Yeah, but still. Yeah, we should get it.
Yeah.
It definitely was a defining moment of her presidency. I mean, it's interesting because, you know, you hang around for ages and next thing, you know, two massive figures from the globe come together. And of course, I mean, Barack Obama was over as well, within 5 days of each other. And yet that visit somehow just is always overshadowed by the Queen's
visit. Did you cover that?
I covered that as well. We were still in, obviously, the bailout, but we were beginning to see a light at the end of the tunnel.
Because you were the only one who saw the light at the end of the tunnel in 2011. It took another couple of years after that.
Well, it was probably, it could have been the lights of an oncoming IMF.
Yeah.
But the Barack Obama visit was, again, just one of those great uplifting things. All those lovely colourful images of down in his, you know, his homestead down in
the plaza.
It wasn't actually
Moneygall. It wasn't the plaza.
The plaza came out. Visit first, then the plaza. So yeah, down in Moneygall, and the big rally he did on, very uplifting rally on College Green. So you had two massively uplifting visits at a time when Ireland really, really needed a lift.
In many respects, I think she became our most personable president in living memory. Not particularly officious, standing on ceremony. And just a little personal story in relation to this. Two or three years into our presidency, there was, at least you're going to laugh at this, but I was at a ceremony in Cork for the Cork Person of the Year. I was one of the nominees.
Were you up for it? Yeah.
I was, right.
Did you win?
I didn't win, of course not. Okay, somebody far more worthy and deserving won it. But there was a dinner in the old Jury's Hotel on the Western Road, which is now gone. Lunch. And for about 400 or 500 people, there were 12 nominees and we were all up on the stage. And President McAleese was there to do the citations and announce the overall winner. So my mother was there as well. And my mother had had a series of strokes and she was in a wheelchair and she was in the room with her carer. And she was in a table down at the end of the room because you wouldn't have been able to get the wheelchair through all the various, because the room was absolutely full. So at the end of the ceremony, I did something something I have to say I probably would never have asked Mary Robinson to do, given that she was regarded as more sort of austere and dignified. But I said to Mary McAleese, I said, President McAleese, I don't know if you could do me a small favour. My mother is in the room, she's in a wheelchair, but she's from Ardoyne, like yourself. And it's after, I was just wondering, maybe before you go, could you actually say hello to her? It would mean a lot to her. And she looks and she goes, this is where we're just about to sit down for lunch. No, we'll do it now. Where is she? So, oh, really? Right. And I brought her down to the far end of the room, the aide de compass, looking, what the hell's going on here? So my chair was vacant alongside my mother's, and Mary McAleese just simply dropped into the chair and started talking to my mother. My mother's speech was very badly damaged by the strokes that she'd had.
But she gave her time, did she?
She spent 5 minutes chatting to her about the Crumlin Road and Ardoyne and growing up. And I just thought this was just an incredibly generous, but it's so spontaneous. She didn't make any sort of calculation that she needed to get on side with the editor of the Sunday Tribune or anything like that. She could just see the minute I said it, I'd want to meet her. But like Mary Robinson, Mary McAleese was too young to retire. And I think has been really, really interesting in the things that she's chosen to become involved in. She became very involved, particularly in the Catholic Church and fighting for women's rights in the Catholic Church.
And same-sex marriage.
And being a thorn in the side of the Catholic Church. I mean, I suspect they can't believe, some people inside of some of the hierarchy there, that the idea that this pesky woman who had been president of Ireland would actually turn next to actually challenging the patriarchy. And she's also showed, I mean, again, this goes back to the thing of the common touch. She has made television documentaries and, you know, she doesn't regard herself that because I have been the president, that I still are Eruchtheron. You know, the way that some people think that once they've reached a certain level, they always have to be treated with that amount of dignity and respect and whatever.
There's nothing in our constitution that says presidents can't say whatever the hell they want to once they're out of the doors.
God, that's from Michael D. Higgins. Have you told him that? God knows what he'll be saying in the months.
We await that. We await that with great interest.
Next time.
I just squeezed his Michael tummy, D, sorry.
Michael D. just started laughing at the most inappropriate moment.
Here, take him.
We should actually point out, anybody just listening, not the real Michael D. It's our little cuddly Michael D.
You've been listening to Think You Know, The Presidents, a Today FM production presented by The Last Word.
And a very big thanks to our guest, Matt Cooper, who didn't win Cork Person of the Year.
Presented by Lise Hand and Flora McCarthy. Researched by Lise Hand, Flora McCarthy and Siobhan Maguire. Recorded by Stephen McLoone. Sound designed by Neil Kavanagh. And produced by Siobhan Maguire. Archive clips from president.ie.
A huge thanks to The Last Word and the wider Today FM team.
You can follow us on Go Loud, Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you enjoyed this, please give us a like and leave a review.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.